Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this morning's issue-specific hearing number 8. And before I proceed through introductory remarks, can I just see a brief show of hands? Is there anybody in this venue, in this building, for the first time? Yes, we do. Right. Okay, well, we will need to just cover off a few preliminary matters. In simple terms, ladies and gentlemen, introducing the venue, there are no planned fire evacuation tests today. So if we do hear the alarms going off, it is the real thing, and it's time to leave the building. The fire exits are clearly marked, and we proceed down the stairs, don't use the lifts, and to an assembly area in the courtyard beneath us. There are ladies and gents facilities to each end of this room. Hopefully everything else is relatively straightforward. My name, ladies and gentlemen, is Rin Smith, and I am the lead member of an examining authority appointed on the 2nd of October 2018 under sections 61 and 66 of the Planning Act of 2008 as amended under delegation from the Secretary of State to examine an application for the Thanet offshore wind farm extension. I won't recite in detail what that application consists of because I trust that everybody is now thoroughly familiar with it. I have made a declaration of interests responding to the Planning Inspectorate's conflicts of interest policy and can confirm that I have no declarable interests in relation to this appointment. My fellow panel members were appointed on the same date, and so I will now ask them to introduce themselves.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Powis, and I can confirm that I've also no declarable interests in relation to my appointment.
And to my left.
My name is Stephen Bradley. I have made a declaration that until August last year, I was a volunteer writer for the Thames Estuary Partnership, and on appointment to this panel, I ceased further involvement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradley. Now, just introducing briefly to our far right, Mr. Robert Ranger, who is a case manager from the Planning Inspectorate and part of the team here to assist us. And also Mr. Bart Barkowiak, who may actually be in the lobby area. I'm not sure if he's... Ah, he is, yes. If anybody at any point has any question about this process that you don't feel able to immediately bring out in the public domain and you wish to seek advice from the Planning Inspectorate on, please make contact with either of these two colleagues who will be very happy to help you at any point. Moving on then, can I direct you to my letter of the 9th of April, which contains the agenda for this hearing? Is there anybody unsighted on the agenda? Is there anybody who would like a hard copy but does not yet have one? No, that's very good news. We also have the excellent facility to display on the screens all of the documents associated with the matters that are being heard. And so if I could ask for today's agenda to be pulled up onto the screens, and we'll proceed on that basis. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, given that you now know who we are, it would be very useful now if we could hear put to us who you are. Just before I commence that process, I will briefly remind you that everything that we do is digitally recorded. We retain the digital record for a minimum of 5 years after the Secretary of State's decision. And so if you participate orally in the hearing, then you are consenting to the retention of that record for that public purpose. So if I can start with Port of Tilbury London Limited, we'll pass around the room in this direction and then we will come to the applicant at the end of the introduction.
So good morning. My name is Robbie Owen from Pinsent Masons, here today representing Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Vincent Crockett from HR Wallingford, again representing Port of Tilbury and London Gateway. And as I mentioned in the previous one, a declaration of interest. We provide navigation simulation services and we have worked with Marico Marine in the past.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Trevor Hutchinson. I'm a planning and transportation consultant representing Port of Tilbury London Limited and London Gateway Port Limited.
Thank you.
Morning. Matthew Carpenter for Pins and Masons, also representing Port of Tilbury and London Gateway Port Limited.
Good morning, Nick Salter from the Maritime Coast Guard Agency.
Good morning, Captain Rakesh Pandit from the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Roger Barker, Director of Navigation at Trinity House.
Good morning, Trevor Harris, Navigation Manager at Trinity House.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Fenna Boyle, UK Chamber of Shipping.
Thank you.
Good morning, Catherine Spain, Harbour Master for the Port of London Authority.
Thank you.
Good morning, Alex Dillostone from Winkworth Sherwood, representing the PLA and ESL.
Okay.
Good morning, Richard Jackson, Launch Cox and Estuary Services Limited.
Thank you. And now to the applicant.
Good morning, Scott Linus, Barrister for the applicant.
Good morning, Sean Leake for the applicant, Gobi Consultants, the EIA lead.
Good morning, Ed Rogers, Shipping Navigation Expert for the applicant.
Thank you.
Good morning, Jamie Holmes, Shipping and Navigation Consultant for the applicant.
Good morning, Simon Moore, Master Owner as a consultant for the applicant.
Good morning, Jennifer Holgate from Womble Bond Dickinson for the applicant.
Good morning, Sammy Mullen, Gobi Consultants on behalf of the applicant.
Thank you very much. Mr Linus, I take it that if anybody else needs to be introduced, you'll bring them forward at the appropriate time. Okay, now there are one or two matters of a preliminary nature that I need to touch on. Just to take you through those, referring to matters arising from yesterday's site inspections, referring to, I guess, the pattern and order of business, how we will deal with certain matters under various agenda items today and tomorrow. A little matter that I want to touch on in relation to our examination questions number two. I will also flag that there are some essentially procedural matters that flow around the applicant's proposal for material change. I propose to embed those in agenda item two separately from essentially governance of the day, because I think they are a separate freestanding item. Okay, so if we just deal with the initial procedural matters, site inspections, we are grateful to Port of Tilbury London Limited and DP World London Gateway for enabling us to view their facilities yesterday. There were three documents that arose from a site inspection. Port of Tilbury London Limited provided a strictly factual digest and breakdown of essentially the nature of the activities on the site and the scale of the activities moving through the site. We would very much like that, as we indicated, as part of the site inspection itself, to be submitted as an examination document, so it's transparently available for everybody and available for comment. Similarly, there were master plans, indicative master plans of both facilities that were simple AO plans, but extremely useful in terms of locating ourselves geographically within the sites. I think it would also assist everybody else participating in the examination if those became examination documents. Any concern or issue about either of those? No. Excellent. Moving then to the agenda and process for today. Now, essentially what we're aiming to do is to spend this morning's session on the initial maritime matters from agenda item two onwards and make as much progress there and onwards into agenda item three as we can. We're proposing to break for lunch to approximately 1:30 p.m. When we return at approximately 2:30 p.m., come what may, it is our view that we will then switch mode. We will then move into the hearing of the Natural Environment Matters, agenda item 8. And the reason that we're proposing to do that is we're very conscious that it's a kind of distinct and almost ring-fenceable set of material. We're also conscious that we do not have Natural England proposing to be in attendance, so quite a lot of the detail of that will then be able to be reserved off into subsequent questions or action list items. And so it can probably be dealt with, we estimate, maybe in 2 hours. And we felt that it was actually quite important to do that, to get it out of the way, rather than have it essentially squeezed out of existence by essentially the maritime matters, where it is maybe harder to make a sensible estimation of the time requirement. So that's what we're proposing to do this afternoon. Round about 4:30, we will then revert to the maritime matters. I then flag that at 6:30 p.m., we move into a separate session around agenda items 9 through to 11, and that we have received notice that Mr. Merlin Jackson, Mr. John Nichols, and can I just clarify, there was a third representative, Mr. Tom Brown. Excellent, thank you very much, who will attend for that session. So we know very clearly what we're doing after 6:30 p.m. We know very clearly what we're doing between 2:30 and 4:30 p.m. And apologies for the jump back and forth, but I think sensibly maritime will fill the gaps. Now, essentially then to say that what we aim to achieve with today on the maritime story is as much clarification and framing of agreement and disagreement, almost a kind of live update of common ground and uncommon ground as we can. We characterise today very much as being about clarification. What we then propose to do is that gives us a complete and free run on Wednesday, where disputed matters can be dealt with in whole with no time barriers in front of them. Now, is that likely to cause anybody any particular problem or concern? No. Well, I'm very glad to hear that, ladies and gentlemen, because I think that then gives us a very clear and separate and coherent way of managing the potentially contended matters on Wednesday, and we can essentially then pursue them for as long as we need. Okay, before I then move on to other procedural and preliminary matters, does anybody have any other questions on just the mechanics of timetabling of the hearing today? No, excellent. I flagged that I wanted to speak to you briefly about our examination questions number two. They were published, and them having been published, it was almost immediately apparent that in the gap between approval and them being rendered into a PDF, the automatic paragraph numbering had played a trick upon itself. So the paragraph numbering in the originally published version of the EXQ2 was not correct. It was taken down on the Friday, the 15th of the 4th, yesterday. A corrected version, I understand, has now been published. All I would say to everybody participating is there's some time in hand before you have to respond to those questions, but please do make sure that if you're in the habit of taking and saving a local copy on the day it was released, that has some paragraph numbering that is not correct. So please do replace your master versions with the version that is flagged up in the banner that was corrected on the 15th of the 4th. Okay, now that's taken me through all of the initial and preliminary matters that I had. Resting aside until we are in agenda item two, any matters about material change, are there any other preliminary matters that anybody now wants to bring or questions that they want to ask before we move into the substantive agenda? Excellent, there are none. In which case, let's move on to agenda item two. Now, what we are essentially aiming to do here is to frame out what has been put to us by the applicant in the SEZ material change request as submitted at both deadlines 4 and 4B, and to deal with questions around arrangements for notice of and consultation on this material, having regard to the Planning Inspectorate's advice note number 16. And we're very conscious that how this process has played out to date may have had some implications for interested parties around the table. We're also conscious that we need to be in absolute and clear agreement about how it will continue to play out and what will be delivered at deadlines bouncing down the timetable hereafter. So what I'm going to suggest that we do first is that we deal with history first, we deal with what has happened, and we then move on to the prospect. What, if any, additional arrangements do we need to make, and what will happen? So starting then, ladies and gentlemen, with history, what has happened. Can I ask the applicant just very briefly to introduce the material that came in at deadline 4 and then the additional material that came in at deadline 4B? And in doing so, I will also place on record the fact that, you know, this examining authority was very conscious that we were pirouetting on a sixpence at points in this process. Because, frankly, we had initially felt that we had been very clear at previous hearings and indeed clear in our procedural decisions that all matters of substance that related to prospective material change in the application ought be finalised and bid into the public domain by deadline 4. And I don't want to necessarily have to go through chapter and verse of individual procedural decisions and letters that we issued, but it is our view that we were very clear about that. Therefore, when we found ourselves in a place where a decision appeared to have been taken by the applicant to essentially partially disclose at deadline 4, but to reserve matters until what was then deadline 4A, we had a very substantial concern, which was that deadline 4A was the time in which essentially this side of the room was meant to respond to us and say, these are the matters that we agree with, and these are the matters essentially that we disagree with and on which we propose to bring evidence that may be subject to cross-examination. Very difficult decision to make if you haven't seen the whole picture. So that's why we pirouetted on a sixpence, and that's why we decided to ask the applicant to bring the material change in front of us, not as swiftly as no doubt many on this side of the room would have liked, but sufficiently before at the new deadline 4B, what then became the new deadline 4C, with 3 days in hand to enable them to respond before they decided what they were doing today. So I thought it was useful to give you a summary of where the examining authority found itself. We are absolutely clear that in procedural terms that you know, there is not perfection in any of that decision making, but we do feel that in the circumstances we made what we hope were the best decisions that we could in the interests of ensuring that nobody came into this room today feeling unsighted on at least the core components of the proposed material change. And what I would say to you, subject to what I hear from all sides in this agenda item, is that we are then also conscious that elements of today's and tomorrow's discussions may not be conclusive. We are also conscious, therefore, that we have deadline 5 beyond us. Deadline 5, you know, I have to say this in words of no more than 2 syllables, must be adhered to. And critically, deadline 5 becomes a point at which clarity around both agreement and disagreement on the matters that we're going to deal with in this hearing has to be achieved. Because if we go beyond deadline 5, and there is still no clarity about matters, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to actually then achieve common ground in ways that enable the parties to have the relevant dialogue necessary to settle common ground. So having made those opening remarks, can I then ask the applicant for its observations on where we got to? And then I will start with Port of Tilbury and I'll pass round the other interested parties, and let's see where we go and see whether we need to... Let's focus on being as essentially positive and curative as we can, whether there need to be any additional procedural arrangements made to put people into the positions that they ought to be to enable them to effectively participate in the examination moving forward.
Scott Lannis for the applicant. Can I start, sir, by saying we're very grateful to the panel for seeking to alter the timetable to accommodate the issue that arose. By way of submission at deadline 4, as you've indicated, sir, we indicated there that there was going to be a proposed structure exclusion zone, and the submission at deadline 4 included an Appendix 14 document which explained the rationale for the structure exclusion zone and its extent. And the main documents supporting that were a review of the ES, which identified in outline terms what changes were going to have to be made by way of documentation and assessment. And there's also an outline NRA. The main reason for all of the material not being submitted to deadline 4 was part, well, really related to the NRA workshops. Clearly, those hazard workshops were going to take place, and it was felt that the NRA, the full version of it, would best assist the examination through submission after those workshops took place. But we recognise the point that you raised, that it was necessary then to amend the timetable accordingly. And we submitted a range of material at deadline 4B, which included the full navigation risk assessment, a review of other application documents, a fuller review of the environmental statement and a range of other documents to support the SEZ, including an addendum to the REIA, a revised Crown Land Plan, a revised Extinguishment of Public Rights Navigation Plan, and a revised Radar Line of Sight Plan. There's also an updated guide to the application and a revised track changes draft ECO. So those documents were submitted at deadline for 4B, and since then, obviously, at deadline 4C, there's been a submission of the statements of evidence, which essentially deal with the material that's already been submitted. So that's really what has happened, sir. We appreciate that other parties have said in their statements of evidence that they haven't had a full chance to review the NRA. However, I would note that following the production of the full NRA, there have been discussions between the applicant and other parties, in particular on dates of the 1st and 2nd of April, where there was some feedback sought following the hazard workshop that took place at the end of March. So the interested parties have had time to look at the hazard results that flowed from the hazard workshop, and they've had some time to look at that in preparation for today. So obviously we'll hear any submissions that other parties have to make, but as far as this agenda item is concerned, the hazard workshop's taken place. The hazard scoring that was agreed at that workshop has been followed through into results, along with results for other hazards which weren't discussed at the workshop, and the parties have had some time to consider those before today. Mm.
So in summary terms then, it would be your general submission that notwithstanding that we're in a fast-moving situation, that there is and has been, in inverted commas, adequate information on the table to enable other interested parties to participate reasonably fully today.
Yes. Following the outline NRA being submitted, the full NRA has been submitted. That takes place in the context of a hazard workshop at which all relevant parties appeared and were able to discuss the hazard log entries. And yes, sir, the information that has flowed from that workshop has been available to parties, so it's there. Yeah. And they haven't been prejudiced in my submission by the way in this material has come forward.
Yeah. There's just one item of history that I wanted to kind of delve into perhaps a little more before we then move into the kind of first the hearing of the other interested parties on this, and also the making of prospective arrangements. And that relates to, I guess, the question of why we found ourselves where we did. The story, as it appears to the examining authority, is that essentially the applicant was seeking to convene the workshop processes around the NRAA, that for whatever reasons, dates, early enough dates to enable those processes to be formally concluded before deadline four, and therefore documented for deadline four, just didn't happen. Can you give me a little bit of a sense of what happened there?
The chronology was this, sir. There was an initial shipping workshop on the 27th of February, which was designed to seek inputs from the interested parties, really to help define what the SEZ might be, and to try and agree parameters for assessment going forward. Then, following that, there was the decision to submit the SEZ, which was issued to stakeholders on the 19th of March. Now, following that, there were pre-hazard workshop meetings which took place either on the telephone or in person between the 21st and the 25th of March, ostensibly to prepare for the hazard workshop meeting itself. And then there was a workshop pack issued on the 26th of March in advance of the hazard workshop itself on the 29th of March. And as I understand it, that was the that was a date which could be arranged for all parties to meaningfully attend.
So reasonable endeavours were made to try and bring the relevant attendees together at an earlier date than that, and were, in your submission, not able to be concluded.
Yes. Following the submission of the SEZ on the 19th of March, then obviously we had to prepare the meeting in relation to that SEZ. And I'm told that the hazard workshop meeting the 29th of March, 10 days later, following the initial pre-hazard workshop meetings on the 21st to 25th of March to set the scene and to see what progress could be made. Then the workshop pack on the 26th of March, so you had your hazard workshop essentially 10 days after the SEZ was issued. I'm told that's really the most suitable date that could be arranged for those discussions to take place and to allow the parties to absorb the SEZ and the workshop material that was produced before then. So that was the 29th of March, and then after that, sir, there were draft hazard logs issued following that workshop on the 1st of April and a workshop teleconference on the 2nd of April to try and run through additional hazard scores that were being drafted by Mr. Rogers following discussions on the four main hazards at the hazard workshop itself. So I think the fundamental point, sir, is that as far as we're concerned, we did make reasonable endeavours following the issuing of the SEZ to convene the hazard workshop and to arrange discussions with all parties beforehand.
Okay. Right. Unless there's anything else specific that you want to put to me on the kind of arrangements, let me then move over to Port of Tilbury London Limited and London Gateway Ports Limited, and then we will march around the room. Now, essentially what I'm seeking from you here at this point is essentially your understanding of what was put before you, when and why, and a starting proposition about your readiness and the scope or any limitations to the scope of your participation in hearings today and tomorrow.
Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway. So I'm not sure I've got a huge amount to say, actually. I mean, it's very helpful what has been said, and I appreciate the summary of the events of the last few weeks that Mr. Lyness gave us, which is, I think, very helpful. Clearly, it's not ideal, I think you've shown great flexibility in changing the examination timetable to suit the turn of events. We are where we are, really. I mean, certainly we've tried to assist the examining authority in preparation for today. We did write to you, you may recall, a week or so ago, saying we weren't able to provide a complete statement of evidence. I'm not sure anybody has, actually.
No.
Probably for the same reason. And we submitted at deadline C a fairly short statement that sets out our analysis of the current position, particularly the addendum to the navigation risk assessment. And importantly, which does form part of evidence, we appended the sort of working draft, if I can call it that, of the HR Wallingford report that we mentioned before, which we hope would have assisted you in preparing for today. I mean, we try to be pragmatic, and as I say, it's not ideal where we are, but we are where we are, and we're ready to participate today and tomorrow, and I think it's fortunate we've got enough time, I hope, today and tomorrow to get to the bottom of these issues, and we'll do our very best to assist you in doing that. I think that's really all I can say. We've set out in our submissions of the 10th of April, the deadline 4C, you know, our current analysis. There are a number of issues we want to explore, as you will have seen, including, I should say, the very concept of a structures exclusion zone. We're very well aware it's been used in other wind farms. That in itself doesn't mean it's the right approach here, and we do want to explore why this is being proposed by the applicant as opposed to a reduction in the order limits, which would certainly be my starting point, and was what other interested parties were also asking for some weeks now. So if I can just mention that we will want to explore why it is that an SEZ is proposed. What are the pros and cons of an SEZ?
Yes.
So that's probably all I can usefully say at this stage. Thank you.
Okay, I'm grateful for those submissions. Essentially, if, if it may assist some of the other interested parties before we hear from you, rest assured that what we feel that we will need to do over these 2 days is to maybe conduct hearings in a more exploratory and discursive manner than is typically the case in NZIP hearings, where normally documentary material is a given and it's been in the public domain for long enough for everybody to be very clear about what's in it, and so we can cut to the chase. We're not quite in a cut to the chase world in these 2 days. Yes.
Just to add to Mr. Owen's comments there, it would be fair to say that the 27th workshop was very much, to use your word, an exploratory effort. And sorry, in February, did I apologize? But the 27th of February workshop, at that stage, the applicant did promote the idea that there would be a change, but the actual description structures exclusion zone was not mentioned at the time. So the rest of that discussion was really quite wide-ranging in terms of what people might consider to be appropriate space. I think that's important, that there is at the 27th of February, there was possibly no hint that it would be a structures exclusion zone rather than just a material change. I think that's
important. Okay, thank you very much. Moving on then from Mr. Owen, if we can then pass down the table. Maritime Coast Guard Agency.
Nick Salter from Maritime Coast Guard Agency. The MCO has been encouraged by the applicant's recent attempts to address the concerns regarding the reduction in available sea room on the western extent through the SEZ, and pleased that the applicant is working closely with the relevant IPs at a local level.
Can I just ask you to maybe draw a little closer to the microphone? I'm not sure the levels are
apologies.
Are good. Thank you.
Yeah, working closely with the IPs at a local level to address the hazard scoring. And the qualitative assessment required for the addendum NRA, and to ensure that it accurately represents present and future scenarios. The MTA feels that the introduction of the SEZ is an improvement, which does increase the amount of available sea room, and it reduces the impact of the pilot boarding areas to some extent. However, the MTA remains concerned that there is no current agreement between the applicant and those IPs whose operations would be directly impacted by the project, and but keen to see that these discussions continue and progress until such time as agreement can be reached where the risk is deemed a LARP with appropriate mitigation.
Now, to focus on essentially the kind of bottom line here, you are then clear that you are ready and able to participate.
That's right,
today.
Yes.
In the light of the material that you've seen, you're not asking for extra time, you're not suggesting that you are somehow unable to participate.
That's correct, yes.
Excellent, right. Thank you very much. Can we then move on to Trinity House?
Thank you. Good morning again. Roger Barker, Trinity House. I wasn't actually at the hazard workshop, but Trinity House do welcome the opportunity to sit around the table. And really, at this stage, I know we're going to discuss further the implications of the SEZ further, but I welcome your statement, Mr. Smith, that we're all able to actually discuss all the factors involved at a later stage in today's hearing. So, for now, I look forward to the debate, the close debate on the issues arising from the proposals.
Thank you very much. UK Chamber of Shipping.
Thank you, sir. Fenner Boyle, UK Chamber of Shipping. So we're very happy with the summary the applicant gave earlier. Thank you for that. We were only able to attend the workshop on the 27th of February, but have been fully kept up to date with the developments happening. So we're fully committed to helping and assisting over the next 2 days and having those discussions and debates.
Thank you. In which case, Port of London Authority and Estuary Services Limited.
Thank you, sir. Alex Dillerstone, Winkworth Sherwood for the PLA and ESL. We're grateful to the examining authority for recognising the time pressures and for the interested parties to consider the documents, given the short time available, and that we'll struggle to properly review the applicant's SEZ proposals and the NNRA in the time.
Can I again just ask you to draw a little closer to the microphone? The levels there weren't.
Is that Is that any better?
That's a little bit better, yeah.
Mr. Linus implied, I think, that deadline four included sufficient information for us to consider the SEZ proposals, and that the Appendix 14 document explained the rationale for the SEZ and its extent, but we found that it did not contain sufficient information to address the PLA and the ESL's concerns about the geographical extent of the activities that would be permitted under the DDCO. And there was no detail about the times at which the SEZ would apply or what activities would be excluded. So in that sense, it was quite easy to evaluate within the time that we had, because there was not very much detail. So unfortunately, it didn't progress matters very far. So in that sense, we were waiting for the revised track change DCO and the further information that we got at deadline 4B. So we have had a rather limited time to go through the information. I'm not saying that we should create more time in the process, because that we just don't have that. But it would like to note that it has not been a lot of time for us to review it. So we will be putting forward our views today, but we would have welcomed more time.
Yeah.
Mr. Linus also mentioned that the main reason for the information not being submitted at deadline four was because the hazard workshops were going to take place, and that they decided it would be better for that workshop to take place before the submission of the proposals. Our records of this show that the meeting was actually originally arranged, the hazard workshop was actually originally arranged for the 2nd of April, and it was only then later brought forwards to the 29th. 29th of March. So we were not aware of any meeting having been arranged prior to that. So our understanding was that it was going to be after the deadline at any event. Following discussion, production of the full NOA, there have been some discussions between the parties, and there has been some feedback. But our view of the workshop was that the PLA and ESL did not manage to get through all of the information that they wanted to get through that day, and there was limited progress made on the day, and there obviously has been very limited time for any of the products of that workshop to be fed into the process and the revised the NRA. And Mr. Linus also implied that there had been agreement as to the product of that workshop. And as far as the PLA and ESL are concerned, there has not been agreement about the scoring at that workshop. It's just that they were told what the scoring would be, which is not necessarily the same thing. So I think we're keen to progress matters today. We're looking forward to doing that. But I think there has been some slower progress than we would have liked so far.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Linus, are there any kind of responding comments you would like to make to us before we move on this?
Scott Linus, the applicant. No, not really. I mean, obviously, we'll get on to the hazard workshop in more detail later. I think it's fair to say at the moment that our recollection of the workshop and what might have been agreed there in the PLA's position is slightly different from theirs, but we'll come back and examine that and explore that in due course later. I think the fundamental point is there's no one around the table saying that we should not proceed today.
That and was my primary health check. That was the purpose of doing this.
And in short, if that's the purpose of this aspect of the examination, I don't need to say anything more.
Yes. No. I think we can safely then decide, I see no suggestion otherwise from either of my colleagues, that it is safe and sound to continue with the hearing of this matter today and tomorrow. Nobody is claiming any special reason why it should not be. But again, I will, as I indicated in my prefatory remarks, flag to you that if we find ourselves treading on detail where we all feel that we haven't sufficiently gripped it for reasons that are very clear, and that could include us as well as you, that what we will do in those circumstances is reserve particular points to be dealt with in writing in the action list by deadline five, and where we ask for that to be done, it absolutely must be done, because if it isn't, looking at the convergence of all roads that needs now to take place to take us to the end of this examination, if anything slips beyond deadline five, those roads just will not converge in the statutory time period of 6 months. So that is a final, I think, and clear warning on that point. So if we then move on to the issue that probably concerns the applicant more in detail terms. Yes, Mr. Owen.
Sir, before we move on, can I just sort of make one sort of point that arises from what was said? I mean, we're here today. We're happy to participate today and tomorrow, and as I said earlier, do what we can to assist the examination. That doesn't mean that we might not want to reflect on all of this towards the end of the examination, and we might want to make some submissions about what has happened and whether that was the right way to have gone about it. So I do need to reserve our position in that, and you'll understand why I'm saying so, but we're very happy to participate today and tomorrow. We're here and ready willing to do so, but that is without prejudice to, you know, any submissions we might want to make in due course.
Now, the purpose of those submissions, just so that we're clear and not euphemistic, are we talking about essentially merits submissions, or are we talking about procedural submissions in relation to, for example, costs, or both?
So it could well be both, yes.
Okay. Given that that last point has arisen, I think I will direct everybody to, you know, the simple proposition that there is a very clear DCLG guidance on the costs point, and it sets out very clearly that a costs application can be made in writing, is expected to be made in writing, in a sense, and does not have even to be made in the duration of the statutory timescale of the examination. 28 days after the closure of the examination is the normal deadline for anything of that nature. And essentially what we would suggest is that we try and remain as focused as we can be on matters of substance, bearing on the merits of the application, and that anybody who wishes then to deal with procedural points relevant to costs, because they have the liberty to do that after the formal closure, that they can then do that then in writing. So everybody content on that point. In which case, ladies and gentlemen, let's move on to the next point, which I think under agenda item 2 is probably more of direct interest to the applicant and a community of people who can't see out there somewhere than it is necessarily to people remaining in this room. So I ask you to bear with us on this. But this is around the issue of arrangements for notice and consultation on the SEZ material change request. Now, here, the examining authority issued a procedural decision to accept the material change request, and some Section 51 guidance around essentially how then to accommodate that request and ensure that persons outside the hearing process are appropriately engaged with it. Now, Mr. Linus, I gather that we may have set off a measure of consternation in your client in terms of what we requested to be done. Before I ask you to respond on the points that were raised in your letter of response to our procedural decision and Section 51 advice, I would like to highlight very clearly that at no point in our advice did we specifically say that the formal requirements of the APFP or the 2017 EIA regulations applied to you. We used the word analogue twice. And I believe that essentially what we directed ourselves to before that advice was drafted was essentially the guidance set out in PIN's advice note 16. We also directed ourselves very closely to the way that similar procedural decisions and advice has been provided by a number of examining authorities since the publication of AN 16 and since the change of the EIA regs, which was one of the triggers around process here, which kind of interposed different timescales, a 30-day consultation period rather than a 28-day consultation period, for example, which it essentially was a driver for the refreshing of process that took place when AN 16 was drafted, and is the rationale for the fact that a number of equivalent material change processes that have taken place since that date have been a little bit more kind of full bells and whistles, if you'll pardon the expression, than were equivalent procedures that took place around a number of examinations prior to that date. For example, we were referred to Rampion, where an SEZ proposal was dealt with, which is to a degree a matter of history because quite a lot of decision making has interposed between then and now. So I thought I would make that clear to you, but tell us the story, and if there's something that we need to do to look at the arrangements that we have, we will, within the very limited time that we have, room for manoeuvre that we have, we'll endeavour to reach a shared position.
Scott Lyons for the applicant. Thank you very much, sir. Yes, we note the reference to the word analogue in the letter, which referred to the 2009 regulations and the 2017 EIA regulations. I think the fundamental point that was raised in the letter was that those provisions, even if they are considered an analogue, essentially refer to consultation as if a new proposed application were being made or a subsequent application were being made under the EIA regulations, which we say isn't obviously the case here. Yeah. The structure exclusion zone is essentially a form of mitigation measure, and as we show in the addendum to the ES, most topics have been scoped out for the purposes of assessment, and those that have been reviewed indicate no change or a reduction in effects. And that sets the context for applying the advice in Advice Note 16. And we've looked at the advice note as well, sir. It recommends that applicants consult those who would be affected by the proposed change, but it anticipates that a targeted approach may be adopted to those affected by the request. And figure 3, paragraph 9, also refers to proportionate additional non-statutory consultation. And I think really that's what we had in mind. I mean, in circumstances where, as I've said, it's a mitigation measure which essentially is designed to reduce impacts. Now, the change is offshore, restricting the placement of turbines and other structures within the identified area. There's no addition to the scheme, and there is exactly the same Rochdale envelope. I think the view that was expressed in the letter was that it wouldn't be proportionate to require exactly the same procedural steps as if this were an entirely new application or a subsequent application. And therefore, we felt that the proportionate approach to take was that following the Annex B to your Rule 8.3 letter of the 4th of April, which summarised the interested persons that should receive electronic distribution of the documentation to which the material change relates. Obviously, those parties can be consulted, have been consulted. We've also suggested that it would be prudent to include a number of other interested persons whose remit relates to offshore matters in varying capacities, and we set out a full list at Appendix 1 of our Deadline 4C letter.
Yep.
The judgment that we reached that's set out in the letter is that we respectfully suggest it wouldn't be necessary to go further in all the circumstances that I have suggested, and it wouldn't be proportionate to essentially treat this as if this were an entirely new application where everyone had to be consulted, particularly in circumstances where we know that anyone who's interested, particularly in shipping and navigation, has been made aware of the changes, particularly following the Annex B letter that the examining authority helpfully drafted. So, in short, we think that the list of persons we propose to consult is proportionate under the guidance. And one other matter I should mention is that that deadline 4C letter said that the applicant was keen to start the 30-day consultation last week, but on reflection, the applicant thought it would be prudent to await the start of that consultation until the hearings took place this week, just in case for anything that arose out of that. So we intend to consult next week for a 30-day period, and that would allow compliance with the timetable that the examining authorities proposed. So in a nutshell, so that was the rationale for not going quite as far as was indicated in the advice.
Okay. Now, what I think we will now do given that you've indicated that you're essentially awaiting the outcome of this process, I've firstly got a very simple question, which is, in terms of then resolving that down to the deadline 6 point, does that leave you enough time?
Scott Lyness for the applicant. I understand that it does leave us enough time with the deadline.
Because our observation was that we thought it did.
Yes.
And I gather there was some telephone conversation between the applicant team and the office at the Planning Inspectorate, putting a proposition that it maybe didn't. Our view is that it still does.
Scott Lyness for the applicant, sir. My understanding, yes, we could do it by starting the consultation, as we suggest, next week, and allowing the 30-day period. That would still allow enough time for the deadline 6 requirements to be met.
Because essentially, if that can be achieved, and our proposition to you is that it can, there is then a bounce down that, as you can see, takes us to one day prior to the end of the statutory examination deadline. If anything else were to be required, we are really running out of time here. And what we had attempted, therefore, to do in that procedural decision was to frame something bluntly that was capable of working. And I'm not sure that we've any room for manoeuvre in time terms beyond that. And drawing attention to the road signs that are liberally scattered through AN16 that flash with exclamation mark the proposition that there is a time in an examination where actually the completion of a full material change request process is hard to achieve. We are literally on that point now. So if you can live with that deadline structure, we believe we can examine what you produce.
Scott Lyness for the applicant. Sir, yes, we are fully aware of the time constraints in play in this case, but we agree that given the scope of consultation that we are indicating, that we could meet the deadline 6 requirement.
Okay. At risk of labouring this point, what we cannot then afford is another, in inverted commas, deadline 4 occurrence. We cannot afford to then get to deadline 6 and find that we don't have the complete package for some reason, because if that happens, we have no room for manoeuvre.
Scott Lyness for the applicant. That's noted, sir.
Okay. In which case, what we will undertake to do is to take offline a final deliberation on the content of that appendix, so that at the beginning of business, we probably reserve it to the very end of the hearing in case anything crops up in the final agenda items, matters arising, we will then just tick off. And so if my colleague can just capture that as an action for us at the end of this hearing, we will tick off the question of the extent of the consultation, so that you do not leave the hearings unclear about any element of the remit of the work that you need to do. Now, I suspect the answer to this is nobody does want to speak on this item, but before closing it, I will just check, does anybody else want to speak on this item at all? Okay, well, in that case, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that that has brought down all the matters that we needed to cover on agenda item 2. I'll just check with my colleagues. That's good. So let us then now move to agenda item 3. Now, this is where we get into the meat of the matter. And so, ladies and gentlemen, although it's a little earlier than I would normally call a morning break, because we have only been in session for an hour, I am going to suggest that we take a 20-minute break, so that instead of having you set out your stall and then be cut off at the knees, that we then move and use all of the remainder of the morning session in one hit to deal with agenda item 3 as far as we can. So, ladies and gentlemen, let us stop now. Let us resume at 11:20, ladies and gentlemen.